fighting double standards in Pakistan. Today, Wednesday, May 14th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Pakistani author chafes against her country's unspoken rules.
Men and boys' sexual behavior is condoned, it's approved of, it's seen with admiration. And women's sexual behavior, girls' sexual behavior, is sought to be controlled and clamped down upon.
She's hopeful, though. Stick around to hear why. Also today, why are there so many C-sections in Brazil?
Around half of all births in Brazil are by C-section. And that number is even higher in the private hospitals, where the rates are around 80 to 90%.
Plus, how to remember the capital of Romania.
Bucharest, not Budapest. The Bud and the book might sound similar, but the pest is different from the rest.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey has gotten used to people protesting against him. But this time, the protests are different. This time, they're coming in the aftermath of a coal mine disaster in western Turkey that left hundreds dead. Today, a big crowd gathered outside the hospital in Soma. That's the town where the accident happened. Some were looking for loved ones still missing. Others protested against the government's poor work safety record. Erdogan responded by promising a thorough investigation. He also said all of Turkey shares in the pain of this disaster. He called it the pain of 77 million. The BBC's Selen Girit is in Soma.
The mood here is full of frustration and grief. Earlier, there was an anxious wait for possible survivors coming out of the mine. But now, it's almost 30 hours since the explosion took place, and the hope has left its place to frustration, as I said, because the energy minister was talking about a carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide poisoning, and what the miners down there had was only gas masks, which could only protect them for 40, 45 minutes. As it's been hours after the accident, the hope that there might be a survivor emerging from the mine has almost totally disappeared. Earlier, I was at a hospital where the injured are being treated, and I saw 13, 15-year-old youngsters protesting against the government, calling for its resignation, and chanting slogans like, "It will be your turn if you stay quiet now."
Are you seeing residents of the town waiting there at the mine, hopefully, for their family members? Because I've been hearing these grim reports of just a parade of dead bodies emerging from this mine, being pulled out.
The journalists are not allowed to go to witness the rescue, search and rescue operations at the moment. But TV footage that I have seen earlier showed very intense, very emotional scenes of people waiting for their loved ones at the mine, just waiting to hear some good news.
You mentioned some of these protesters who are really angry. They're shouting at Prime Minister Erdogan, who was actually, I gather, in Soma earlier today. Why the anger directed at the Prime Minister?
The Prime Minister, as you said earlier today, visited this town and gave a speech comparing the disaster that has taken place here to what has happened in Europe in the beginning of 1900s. And he said, well, this is the nature of this job. When you're in mining, these kinds of things happen. That kind of attitude probably was the main reason of the frustration and the protests that took place today. And I have to add one more thing. They are particularly complaining about the lack of mining security in this town. The opposition had asked for an inquiry, a parliamentary investigation to take place about the mining security, particularly in Soma, but that inquiry was rejected by the government just 2 weeks ago. And the people here know about that, and they want more, they expect more from the government now that over 240 people have lost their lives.
The BBC's Selen Girit in the Turkish town of Soma, where that tragic coal mine disaster continues to unfold. Selen, thank you.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Tunisia over in North Africa also has a lot of recent experience with protests. That's where the Arab Spring revolution started. Tunisia is also unique among Arab nations when it comes to enshrining women's rights into law. For instance, abortion became legal there in 1973, the same year as here in the U.S. And just this past January, the country's new constitution officially mandated strict equality between men and women. But Tunisians say that in the private sphere, some traditions die hard, like the expectation that a bride be a virgin. Marine Olivesi has our story from Tunis.
It started like any teenage love story. Mariam met a boy at taekwondo practice. She was 16, red belt. He was 18, black belt. They started dating.
We go everywhere together. I trust him, he trusts me, and everything goes okay.
They'd been together for 2 years, when last summer, Mariam was feeling pressured.
When a girl loves a boy and she trusts him, he will look for something, what he wants. All boys want sex here.
And so one day it happened, but it didn't take long for Mariam to regret it.
Here in Tunisia, our tradition, no guy will marry some girl that she's not virgin. So I didn't know what should I do. I was confused. I was so worried and lost. I don't sleep enough. I just was thinking about what happened. I thought that I made a big mistake, a huge mistake.
Seeing Mariam so distressed, her boyfriend came up with an idea. She could do a hymen reconstruction surgery, and she'd be like a virgin again. All it takes is a couple of hours at a clinic and $300. He even offered to pitch in. Mariam did the surgery in August, but rather than bring them together, she says he grew distant and uninterested. She broke up.
I wish that I never met him. I never loved him, and I wish that I will forget this moment, that bad moment, actually. It was a good moment, but it's life. It's happened, and we continue.
Mariam studies in Tunis, the capital. Like many women here, she wears eyeliner, lipstick, no headscarf. She says her parents are quite liberal. In fact, Mariam even told her mother about it. And she also helped come up with the money for the surgery. While she was understanding, Mariam says her mother was still mad at her for losing her virginity.
Ce que j'ai remarqué, c'est que ce n'est pas, d'abord, ce n'est pas une question de classe sociale.
Nadra Ben Smail is a psychoanalyst. She says female virginity is still seen as a holy grail by most Tunisians, whatever their social background, gender, or education. She wrote a book 2 years ago about the re-virgination trend in Tunisia and questioned hundreds of women. 3 out of 4 told her they had done or would consider doing the surgery, which essentially closes the hymen. Ben Smail says the lifestyle here has changed dramatically, and that's created a paradox in Tunisian society.
More women now study well into their 20s. They start working and only get married on average at age 30. But before that, of course, they'll fall in love, they'll experience things. And yet, they're still stuck in a conservative culture rooted in Islam that requires them to be a virgin when they marry. That's created an identity and social crisis in our society. And so medicine has provided a fix.
In the Tunisian dialect of Arabic, a girl who's lost her virginity is said to be broken. Dr. Kamel Monsef says he repairs up to 100 women a year, a clear upswing since he started working 20 years ago. And with the number of weddings soaring in the spring and summer in Tunisia, now is when most of the women show up at his practice.
En privé, généralement, on le fait quand il y a peu de monde.
We make the appointments during down hours, when there are few people at the clinic. Otherwise, they come in with glasses, a hijab, so nobody can recognize them. They're just a silhouette. And usually, I never see them again. They try to avoid the gynecologist who did this procedure. For them, I'm a reminder of their past, and they want to forget about it.
But if women want to forget, he says, men are in denial. On a Sunday afternoon, I go out and ask guys clustering at a sidewalk cafe for their take on the whole thing. Unlike most women, they're not shy about sharing their bedtime adventures.
He says that just last night he had sex with a girl, and it's over 10. Way, way, way over 10 girls. Sexual partnerism.
Saif, 23, is an off-duty police officer. And in my translator's own words, un beau gosse. his heart.
But he said if he's going to be engaged with a woman, he wants her to be clean, as he put it like that. Never touched by a guy, never had any contact with a guy, you know?
The women I've talked to say that's the problem. To this day, men think of women as two groups, the ones they sleep with and the ones they marry. But with so many women resorting to surgery, what they don't realize is they're often one and the same. Like other men I questioned, Saif says he will know the difference between a real and a fake virgin, though he admits he's never slept with a girl who's done the surgery, so he can't know for sure, and he hopes he'll never have to find out.
He's against this surgery. He's not okay with the woman who cheats on him, or she's not saying the truth since the beginning.
Telling the truth or not, that's the dilemma Mariam faces now. She has a new boyfriend, but still hasn't decided whether and how to tell him. She's afraid that might end their relationship. For The World, I'm Marine Olivezi in Tunis.
As we heard, even as society becomes more modern, old habits die hard in places like Tunisia. You could say the same about Pakistan. Beena Shah writes this week in the New York Times that opinions about women's role in Pakistani society are evolving, but slowly. Shah is a Pakistani author. She joins me now from her home in Karachi. So we just heard the story from Tunisia about the demand that women be virgins when they marry. Beena, a throwback to an earlier age, but it contrasts with a hypocrisy expressed by that man at the end. He slept with a lot of women, none that he'd marry, though. How do you encounter this in Pakistan?
Men and boys' sexual behavior is condoned, it's approved of, it's seen with admiration. And women's sexual behavior, girls' sexual behavior, is sought to be controlled and clamped down upon.
And in that column for The Times, you look specifically at sex education for girls in Pakistan. And I'd imagine sex ed for girls is helping to push back on the traditionalism. But how have the traditionalists pushed back on sex ed for girls?
Where it has been introduced, there's been protest, and those schools, private schools, have had to roll back on their classes. And the program that I was talking about was a very small pilot program that took place in the rural area, so even more ingenious, even more revolutionary. But how they did it was that they had to really rebrand sexual education. They had to call it life-based skills. They had to be very careful when they were talking about sexual activity, not link it specifically to contraception, not link it specifically to things like abortion. They had to really tread carefully.
I got to say, we've got similar tensions in the West. I mean, usually played out along urban versus rural divides or red states versus blue states. And when you think about it that way, it's kind of hard to see where it all could be headed. I mean, maybe even more polarized is one scenario. Is it that clear for you that it's going to change for the better in Pakistan?
I'm absolutely convinced about it because we have so many influences. We've got, you know, things like cable television, satellite television. We've got the internet. We've got so many ways to access information that was previously blocked to people before. And it's interesting what you said, the comparison to what's going on in the United States. A lot of comments that I received on the New York Times piece actually pointed out we have the same issues going on in the U.S. with still debates taking place about how much control a woman has over her own body. Does she have the right to contraception, to the emergency contraceptive pill, to abortion, et cetera, et cetera?
Child marriage, also one of the traditions that's long gone unchallenged in Pakistan. How's that being discussed in these sex ed classes?
Well, child marriage as a topic is coming up a lot these days. Recently in the province of Sindh, where I live, the Child Marriage Act was passed, which makes marrying under 18 illegal. So we're having a lot of conversations about the topic.
So you sound optimistic.
I'm always optimistic about my country. I always see the positivity. I always see the forward motion, because what other choice do we have?
Pakistani author Beena Shah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Later, that country in South America, it's spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-I-A. You won't forget it after you hear the story on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. My dad once worked as an obstetrician, and what he used to say is that C-sections are designed as an emergency procedure to get a baby out of a woman's womb when complications arise during vaginal childbirth. It's not supposed to be how birth happens. But in some parts of the world, it's practically becoming the norm. In Brazil, for example, that's where Global Health editor Marissa Miley went to examine the extraordinary rate of unnecessary C-sections for Global Post.
Around half of all births in Brazil are by C-section, and that number is even higher in the private hospitals, where the rates are around 80 to 90%. And from my interviews with doctors and with women, it seems that there are several reasons why this is the case. I was learned about this culture of scheduling in Brazil, where women want to be able to say, well, I'll be out of town this week, but my husband will be in town this week, and I'd like to have my delivery on a Tuesday.
So people want to be organized, so they're going to schedule their birth ahead of time.
Exactly.
Wow, that's kind of odd.
I think there's also a perception that it's more modern and clean. I talked with a number of women who felt that natural or normal childbirth was something dirty and grotesque. And a doctor told us that the reason that women fear childbirth is not unfounded, really. And that's because many doctors actually may refuse pain relief during labor process, and they may not allow women to have their loved ones, their husband, in the room with them during delivery.
So it sounds like there are a lot of complex reasons why this is happening. It may help to put this into one narrative of a woman who's gone through this. Tell us the story of what happened just last month to this woman, Adelir Carmen Lemos de Goes.
Adelir was a mother of two. She's 29 years old, and she was pregnant with her third child. Her first two children had been delivered by a C-section. But for her third child, she wanted to have a normal delivery, a vaginal delivery. When she got to the hospital, the doctor was really urging her to have a C-section, and she did not want to have one. She ultimately went home to sort of see how the labor would progress. And as she described, nine policemen showed up at her door demanding that she go back to the hospital. And actually, the hospital had sought a court order to force Adelir to have a C-section. She did. The baby was healthy, but it really catalyzed this debate in Brazil over a woman's right to her own body.
How common a case is this?
This particular case fell to one extreme of the spectrum, but I certainly spoke with a number of women who felt pressurized to have C-sections. I spoke with one woman in Recife. Her name was Carla Pimentel. She's 34 years old. When she was pregnant with her first child, she was 39 weeks along. She was progressing normally with the labor. She had told her doctor again that she wanted a normal delivery. She got to the delivery room, was in labor for 4 hours. The doctor, even though she was dilated and everything was going normally, the doctor said, I'm sorry, this is not safe. I need to give you a C-section, and force her to have the C-section despite her wishes. And as she describes it, you know, she'd already had the epidural. She couldn't literally walk out of the hospital.
The cesarean rate for the United States was a little over 4% of all births when it was first measured in 1965. Today, apparently one in three mothers gives birth by C-section in the U.S. So similar trend, but what's different between the U.S. and Brazil?
I think it's become increasingly popular for similar reasons in Brazil. I think there is an element of convenience to it, but I think it's also the mentality among doctors that it's safer somehow. And I know that recently American doctors came out with new guidelines trying to reduce this number, because the World Health Organization recommends that the percentage of C-sections in a population be no more than 15%. So here we have Brazil at over 50%. We have the U.S. at, I think it's like 34%. China also has a very high rate of C-section at nearly half. There are risks to these C-sections. It's a major surgery.
Clearly, a C-section is needed. It can be an emergency and life-saving procedure. It's interesting. You were doing this research, Marissa, while you yourself were pregnant. What's going to a place like Brazil done to change your own expectations of childbirth?
So I am nearly 7 months pregnant. It has made me really quite grateful of the discussions that I do have with my doctor here in the States about what I want. If my doctor says that a C-section is necessary, I think I'll want to ask more informed questions about what exactly is going on and whether or not this is indeed the right path forward.
Marissa Miley, Deputy Editor of Global Health for Global Post, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Every birth has its story, and we'd like to hear yours as part of our ongoing series, The Ninth Month. We've already received several incredible submissions, and we look forward to hearing more from all you mothers and fathers out there. You can share your birth story at pri.org/birthstories. When you first arrive in a country, you're sometimes not sure how to act. That's one theme we've been hearing in our First Day series, in which immigrants recall their first days here in the U.S. Today's installment comes from poet and author Marjorie Agosin. She and her family moved to the U.S. from Chile when she was a teenager in 1969.
When I came to the United States, and we came due really for political reasons, because my parents did not want to live under a dictatorship, but we came almost 6 months before the overthrow of Salvador Allende. So coming to the U.S. was extremely hard, and it's something I think about a lot, because first of all, I didn't speak English. I had very few friends. People made fun at school at me. I was bullied. It was a very dark time of my childhood, and something I don't wish upon anybody. I used to hide in a closet, as if the own closet of the home we had in Georgia protected me. And every time a relative from Chile came to see us, I used to almost hold on to them and ask them to take me back home. And my parents knew that. But strangely, I have two siblings. They adjusted in a much better way than I did. But I think they adjusted because they decided to become Americans. And I couldn't become an American so easily. And I survived because I always wrote poetry as a young girl. And I wrote this poetry in Spanish because the only thing I felt that I had to hold on that was completely mine was my language. And I think now that I am an older woman now, I was able to capture the life of young immigrants through my writing. It's taken me almost 40 years to be able to do it, because I don't want young people that come from other countries to suffer. I want them to feel welcomed and mostly to feel loved, because I did not feel loved when I went to school in Athens, Georgia. There are many virtues of this country that I love. The virtue of opportunity, the virtue that you can dream the things you want to be and become. But I still think I remain at heart a Chilean. I like spontaneous life. I don't like to plan things. When I was very young here and I suffered a lot, my mother says, take the best of both worlds. And I think her wisdom has stayed with me, and I have taken the best of both worlds.
Poet Marjorie Agosin spoke to the world's Shirin Jafari. Agosin also shared some of her pictures from those first young days of hers in the U.S. You can see them at PRI.org. World News headlines are coming up in just about a minute. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a New York man so obsessed with his Ukrainian heritage that he applied to join an all-female Ukrainian chorus.
And I went to the director. I'm like, hey, I'm a guy, but I really want to sing this music. And she was beautiful enough to be like, we accept everybody that comes, and you're just going to have to sing a little high. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll do it.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org. And from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Yemen is home to what Washington has called the most dangerous branch of al-Qaeda. 3 weeks ago, the U.S. stepped up drone attacks against al-Qaeda bases in the south of the country. The Yemeni army joined in with a major air and ground offensive that's still going on. We haven't heard much about this war in Yemen because there are few Western journalists there to tell the story. And in the past week, the few accredited journalists who were there have left. Joining us now from London is a reporter who's covered Yemen for the past 3 years. Iona Craig, we usually speak with you from your home in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Why are you not there now?
I decided in the last few days to take a bit of a break from Sana'a. The kind of madness and sense of chaos is quite strong there at the moment. And also a colleague of mine was deported last week, a journalist, American journalist by the name of Adam Barron. And in the hours that he spent in jail, there was then an indication that they were going to be coming after other foreign journalists, and my name was actually mentioned. So it was a tense few days of anticipation of whether that was going to happen or not. And in the end, I actually decided to take a break myself and to leave the country rather than being kicked out of the country.
Now, you tweeted on May 10th that many have suggested I should keep quiet and lay low, but I've run from this government too many times in the past. And maybe you can just talk about some of the fraught security scenes in Sana'a and around the country. One episode right in the capital a few weeks ago, a shooting in a barbershop. Two U.S. embassy personnel opened fire on Yemenis. What happened?
Actually, that's not an unusual incident against foreigners at the moment, unfortunately, in Sana'a. They appeared to have come up against two armed men who were attempting to kidnap them. Those American US embassy workers were obviously armed and shot back and killed the two gunmen who were apparently attempting to kidnap them. There has been a huge spike in kidnappings and kidnapping attempts of Westerners in Sana'a in the last few months, and particularly in the last few weeks. That has escalated not just to kidnapping attempts, but actual assassinations. We had a worker at the EU delegation in Sana'a who was shot dead. The German embassy staff came under fire. The international community, as far as the UN agencies, Western embassies, NGOs, they're all on restricted movements. And in fact, most of them are actually on lockdown at the moment. They're working from home.
Yeah, another big source of tension these last few weeks happened to represent one of the biggest drone deployments in Yemen ever, from what I understand. How should these drone strikes be viewed by Americans?
I think what we saw in about 3 weeks ago, when this current kind of military offensive against al-Qaeda really began, that was launched with a series of drone strikes, along with Yemeni Air Force strikes in the south of the country.
And how does the current offensive compare with things you've seen in the past?
I have to say, I think this is the largest offensive that's ever been seen in Yemen against al-Qaeda. We saw a previous military offensive in Abyan in 2012. But this military offensive, yes, it seems to be much more determined and focused on a military victory, if you like. And it's also included that fight being taken to the streets of Sana'a. So we've had counterterrorism operations, counterterrorism raids by Yemeni special forces in Sana'a, in the capital, which we didn't see the last time. And of course, all of those kind of actions have repercussions of a backlash by al-Qaeda and its affiliates, so that we end up seeing this increased violence in Sana'a as a result of all of those actions.
But now you're not in Yemen. And at the same time, as you told us earlier, journalists are being kicked out of the country. That's got to be affecting coverage. What does all this suggest to you?
Suggests to me that if they are trying to prevent or remove journalists from Yemen, that they have something to hide, that they have something that they don't want us to witness. That's, of course, always the indication when governments want to remove journalists. Obviously, then becomes very difficult to see what the military are doing, what is going on in the south of the country, where the only reports that we've had coming out of Shabwa, where this military offensive is going on, have come from the Ministry of Defense on one side or from al-Qaeda and their propaganda on the other. There has been absolutely no independent coverage of what's happening down there. And I think we really have to, for those of us that are outside the country like I am now, keep a close watch on what is going on in Yemen.
Iona, you've been so determined in your Yemen coverage and passionate. If for some reason you are not permitted to return, what will that mean to you personally?
I don't know. I'll have to go and find another job, I suppose. or somewhere else to work, anyway. Somewhere else to work. I've been living there for over 3.5 years. It's my home. I've got a lot of friends there. I didn't tell most of them that I was leaving when I planned to leave. I just kind of hit a wall at the weekend and thought, this is enough. I want to control my own life. I don't want my life depending on when the national security is going to come knocking on my door and be having to permanently look over my shoulder, as I've done on several occasions in the last few years. And I just needed to step back from that kind of madness. But at the same time, that didn't mean I never wanted to go back. And so, yes, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get back in the country again or how difficult the government's going to make it. But the one thing I can guarantee is I'm going to try.
Journalist Iona Craig speaking with us from London. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Closer to home now. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Since then, many American farmers have grumbled that Mexican products have been flooding U.S. grocery stores, hurting their bottom line. Well, it works both ways, of course. Mexican apple growers now argue that American apples heading south have pushed their industry to the brink of collapse. But they're not going down without a fight. Bridget Huber reports from the Mexican state of Chihuahua, where some 70% of Mexico's apples are grown.
After 50 years in the apple business, Vicente Robles is cutting down most of his orchards. The trees are still productive, but no longer profitable. This year, Mexican growers produced a record harvest.
We were very happy because the harvest was coming well after 2 years of not having one.
But their bumper crop came after a year of record imports of American apples. By the time the Mexican growers were ready to sell their fruit, markets were already filled with apples from up north. Mexican grower Isai Gomez trucked his apples to wholesale markets in different cities. He found no takers. He said he had to give up and sell his apples to the juice companies. They paid him less than a third of what it cost to produce the apples. Now, growers can't pay their workers or their bills. Chihuahua's apple industry, which employs about 35,000 people, tried to get the Mexican government to suspend U.S. imports. In February, growers staged what they called a survival march. Others dumped apples in the streets in protest. The Mexican press was sympathetic. A local newspaper headline read, "Gringo apples, ugly, old, and cold." Mexican Senator Patricio Martinez from Chihuahua tried forcing federal action. He did it standing on a box of unsold apples on the Senate dais in Mexico City.
Alguien en el extranjero quiere acabar con las plantaciones nacionales para que entonces México dependa.
Someone from outside our country wants to do away with Mexico's apple plantings so that Mexico will become dependent on their production at their prices and their conditions.
He also accused the U.S. of illegally dumping, selling apples at a lower price than production. Up in Washington state, they see the situation much differently.
We really feel that there's room for both industries in the market.
Rebecca Lyons is the International Marketing Director for the Washington Apple Commission. She says, yes, they sold a lot of apples in Mexico last year, but that's because Mexico had so few apples of its own. She says Mexican growers caused their own heartache. They grew too many apples.
Everybody just harvested whatever they could. They didn't thin. They didn't use good management practices. They have to do something to help themselves.
Lyons added that they're also growing more and different varieties up north, and that gives Mexican consumers more choice. Mexican growers say they aren't against more trade, but they want more trade oversight. They're asking the government to block U.S. imports around harvest time to give them more of a chance to sell their apples. But U.S. government officials say that would violate the terms of NAFTA. Laura Carlson calls NAFTA a straitjacket. She directs the Americas program at the Center for International Policy and is based in Mexico City.
What it does is it strips the government of a series of very important development tools that the United States, of course, had during its period of development. These include the ability to protect strategic sectors. And if there's any strategic sector, the production of basic food would be one. All the deck is stacked against these small farmers, but in the end, everybody's going to pay a price.
Since NAFTA was signed, countless Mexican small farmers have been driven out of business and crossed the U.S. border illegally, looking for work up north. Others have remained in Mexico and turned to the drug cartels, which are always recruiting.
Oye, ¿todavía llevan manzanas ahí?
Apple growers in Chihuahua are hoping to avoid that fate. But it might be tough. Back at Vicente Robles' packing house, he points to the dregs of the failed season. Crates of tired yellow apples.
There is a feeling of powerlessness. I'm 71 years old. I've spent my whole life working here. And now I've arrived at this point and my orchards don't even give me enough to live on.
He says it's sad, but he has to be practical and move on. Apple grower Isai Gomez vows that he won't go down without a fight. He's going to teach his sons to defend the countryside. He says they're fighting for not just their livelihood, but their way of life. For The World, I'm Bridget Huber, Chihuahua, Mexico.
Bridget's story was produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Let's talk about a different kind of dispute now. This one's over the spelling of the name of another Latin American nation, Colombia. Foreigners routinely spell it with a U, like Columbia University or the District of Columbia. And Colombians are sick of it. Now, spell checkers in Bogota have taken to social media to inform the world that the correct spelling is Colombia. Reporter John Otis has that story.
I've been living in Colombia for 17 years, but I still get emails from family and friends, even editors, who misspell the name of my adopted country. They have some high-profile company. Tweeting about recent visits here, Paris Hilton and Justin Bieber spelled Colombia with a U. In announcing Colombian tour dates, Black Sabbath's lead singer Ozzy Osbourne also got it wrong. Now, granted, Paris, Justin, and Ozzy aren't exactly public intellectuals, but others should know better, says Carlos Pardo, an executive at a Bogota web design company.
I think these mistakes happen every day. We've seen that it happens a lot to celebrities. We see that it happens a lot in media. We see that it happens a lot, like, in museums or expositions of things about Colombia, and they tag the name with a U. Let's see what else we have here.
Pardo surfs the web to prove his point. Sure enough, press releases and websites for Starbucks, Lufthansa Airlines, Virgin Mobile, and Germany's Bundesliga Soccer League have all spelled Colombia with a U. Brooklyn's Botanical Garden made the same mistake for its display of Colombian orchids.
It happens all the time.
Frommers. That's the travel guide.
Yeah.
How can a travel guide get the name of the country wrong?
Exactly.
Colombia.
Esa es la idea de It's Colombia, not Colombia.
To promote the correct spelling, Pardo has helped create an online campaign called It's Colombia, not Colombia.
Resaltamos la forma correcta de escribir nuestro nombre.
Thousands of volunteer spell checkers have joined. When they spot mistakes, they send messages via Twitter, Facebook, and email, politely seeking corrections, which are often made. But people have been misspelling Colombia for years, so why now?
Colombians never used to try to correct.
Spell check activist Tatiana Gonzalez says it's because Colombia's doing so much better these days. Drug-related violence has diminished, the economy is growing, and tourism is on the rise.
Our country has changed so much during this time that now we feel confident, and now we have, like, this newfound pride. We have gained, like, the position to now stand up and say, hey, guys.
Colombian Army Colonel Javier Carvajal is familiar with both spellings. He went to high school abroad in the District of Columbia, and he thinks that It's Colombia, Not Colombia campaign is a waste of time.
To be honest, people who think like that, probably they don't have too many things to do, you know, so they start thinking like, oh my God, it's unrespectful.
So there's bigger fish to fry?
Kind of.
Still, Colombians aren't the only ones demanding accuracy. When the Iron Curtain came down, Michael Jackson and other Western artists performed in the Romanian capital of Bucharest while telling concertgoers it was great to be in Budapest, the capital of Hungary. Last year, a Romanian candy company launched a campaign to clear up the confusion.
Rom presents Bucharest, not Budapest. The Bud and the Book might sound similar, but the pest is different from the rest.
Getting the most basic information correct is also a matter of respect. And to be fair, Colombians don't always get it right, like when they spell my name J-H-O-N instead of J-O-H-N. But somehow, that seems more forgivable. This is the Bogota Planetarium. On display here is a handful of moon rocks that were gathered by the Apollo 17 astronauts in 1972 and donated to Colombia by President Richard Nixon. The dedication plaque from the Nixon administration says, "Presented to the people of Colombia," spelled with a U. 41 years later, the typo has yet to be corrected. For The World, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We talk a lot about ethnic identity and culture on The World. After all, this is America, the land of immigrants, you know, given you're tired, you're poor, and Americans have family roots all over the globe, right? But what if your family has been here so long that you kind of feel left out of the melting pot? Contributor Alina Simone recently met someone in New York who struggled with that.
I met Brian Dolphin for the first time when he arrived in my apartment wearing a fox mask and singing ancient Ukrainian songs. Now, this was in January, before Ukraine became a daily fixture on the news. Brian is the founder and musical director of Ukrainian Village Voices. The group announced they'd be caroling door-to-door to celebrate Kolia Da, an ancient pagan tradition in Ukraine. So I invited them over. I was born in Ukraine, but don't speak any Ukrainian or own an embroidered blouse. I'd never even heard of this holiday. Brian, on the other hand, was born in America. The irony of all this was not lost on me. Still, I assumed his family connection to Ukraine must be strong. It turns out to be more of a maybe.
It's either my great... No, it's my great-greats on my father's side. My father's 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 father. I think that's how it works.
Brian's story got me thinking about how much the ethnic background we claim, or aspire to claim, has to do with the family members we relate to the most, or the things we love, our random obsessions. Brian is a scholar of ethnomusicology. In his case, family lore collided with seeing Slavic folk music performed live for the first time while traveling the world on a post-collegiate fellowship.
Like a year. I've been like traveling around the world, studying in like India and Norway and Peru and Cameroon, and Bali, all these places, and I finally come to a place where, by happenstance, my people from my lineage are there. And that's when it was like, oh man, these roots, I have these roots too.
He got so into it that when he returned, he joined New York City's only Ukrainian choir, an all-women's choir.
And I went to the director, I'm like, hey, not, I'm sorry I'm a guy, but hey, I'm a guy, but I really want to sing this music. And she... Nadia Tarnovsky, she was beautiful enough to be like, we accept everybody that comes and you're just going to have to sing a little high. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll do it.
Now that takes major cojones. When that choir disbanded, Brian formed Ukrainian Village Voices and became one of the key organizers on the Ukrainian folk scene here in New York. As you might guess, he gets asked a lot about his ties to Ukraine and this mysterious ancestor. I think we all have mythic kin in our families. The Cherokee great-grandmother, the mysterious bootlegging uncle, sketchy claims to third-tier nobility. That's a favorite in my family. But I started wondering how hard it would actually be to hunt down Brian's Ukrainian roots. My family has its own resident genealogist, great-uncle Oleg in St. Petersburg. But Brian didn't, so I decided I would be his uncle Oleg. Since Brian suspected his great-great-whatever was Jewish, I started my search at the Center for Jewish History. Despite the name, it turns out you don't even have to be Jewish to use the center. As Chief Operating Officer Michael Glickman explains,
we're a public destination, so people of really any background can walk in off the street and get the same expertise and the same assistance that a person of Jewish ancestry could as well.
Okay, but Brian barely has any information about his alleged relative, just a last name in a region of Ukraine, Galicia. No problem, says Miriam Weiner, senior advisor to the Genealogy Institute here. In little more than an hour, she's found some promising leads.
I found a Jewish name of Dolphin, D-A-L-F-E-N, from this town of Kalamea, and I actually found two separate families, one of them in house number 112 and one in house 396.
Miriam would need to know more in order to prove these were the right dolphins, Brian's dolphins, but she does hand me a folder full of information about his bona fide great-grandfather, William. And when I share this with Brian back at my place, it's pretty awesome.
He served. He was in World War I. Psh, look at that. Wow, look. Flying school. Cool. Pilot. I've always liked planes.
I like this method of genealogy better. Follow your muse backward in time until you find the ancestor you're looking for, the one who matches your personality best. The truth is, the Ukrainians who sang the ancient songs Brian loves to sing wouldn't even have considered his ancestor one of them if he was really Jewish. Me? I've been half Slavic, half Jewish all my life, and I'm ready for something new. My plan? Get one of those internet gene kits and prove I'm actually half Viking, half Neanderthal. That's pretty much how I feel inside. As for Brian, last time we talked, he was at the Jewish Center in search of his father's 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 father. For the World, this is Alina Simone from New York.
Finally, we remember Malik Bendjelloul. He was a freelance filmmaker from Sweden who shot to fame almost overnight with his Oscar-winning documentary, Searching for Sugar Man. It's about singer Sixto Rodriguez, who never managed to get popular here in the U.S., but was a superstar in South Africa without knowing it. If you haven't seen the film, you should. Last night, we learned that Malik Bendjelloul died at the age of 36. When Searching for Sugar Man came out, our friend Beto Arco spoke with Bendjelloul at length. Beto, tell us what made a half-Algerian, half-Swedish 30-something become obsessed with a story about a Mexican-American folk singer who never got his due. What did he tell you?
Well, you know, I interviewed him on my program here in Los Angeles on KPFK. He said that he was looking for a subject for his next project, and he saved up his money, and he started traveling around the world, and he came upon the story of Rodriguez, and this is what he told me.
I found this guy is as good and as famous as the Rolling Stones here in South Africa. Then I walked out in the streets of Cape Town, just asked random people, have you ever seen this album, Cold Fact by Rodriguez? And I was like, what do you mean, if I ever seen? Of course I see this album. It's like asking me if I've seen Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles. It's one of the most famous albums ever. And then I listened to the songs and it's like, oh my God, it really is one of the lost masterpieces of our time, I think.
So filmmakers who uncover stories like these often end up becoming the star themselves because they've discovered something great. I mean, it sounds, though, like Malik Bendjelloul, from what I understand, wanted the spotlight and story to stay on Sixto Rodriguez. Did you get the sense of humility when you met Malik Bendjelloul?
Oh, my God. He was the most humble yet very passionate person. And you could sense that he was really respectful of Rodriguez's life and what he became.
Well, Malik Bendjelloul certainly told us an incredible story, and sadly, he's gone at the age of 36. Beto Arcos, thank you for telling us about Malik today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
Sugar man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Silver magic ships.
That's our program today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, ritaallen.org, by the PRI New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.